Hello, everyone. Before we get started on today's episode, I am absolutely delighted to announce that I will once again be a guest at AnacroCon this month, from February 26th to the 28th. AnacroCon is a steampunk and alternate history convention based here in Atlanta. They have everything from costuming and construction to literature and horror, and I am thrilled to have the opportunity to act as a presenter for a second year. I will be talking about spiritualism, sharing ghost stories, and much more. You can find a list of my panels over at exquisitelyodd.com under Events. Pre-registration is open until the 16th, so if you're interested in attending, get your tickets before the price goes up. Of course, you can also get tickets the day of. You can find all the necessary information at anacrocon.org. Now, on to the show. Welcome to Courting Casualties. I'm Megan Harker. We've all seen or read about grave robbers, people who steal into cemeteries at night to dig up the deceased and rob them of their gold fillings and jewelry. But what about the people who are after the bodies themselves? Before being a surgeon or physician was a respectable practice, those seeking a medical education needed bodies to dissect. With the living less willing, considering being admitted to a hospital at all was a bit like playing Russian roulette, students resorted to scavenging the dead. Of course, stealing has its consequences. The Doctor's Riot of 1788 has a few different origin stories. One claims a couple of boys, playing outside a New York hospital, saw a blood-soaked, severed arm hanging out a window. The alternate version, which is a far better story, is my favorite. Again, a group of boys were playing outside a New York hospital, by a window looking into a room where Richard Bailey, or perhaps his student, John Hicks, was dissecting an arm. Spying the boys, Hicks did what any fine doctor would do. He used the severed arm to wave at them. Then he may or may not have told one of the boys, whose mother had recently died, that it was her arm. The boy ran home and told his father. Upon exhuming the mother and finding her grave empty, things took a bad turn for Dr. Hicks and the rest of New York's medical teachers and students. A mob of angry citizens broke into the hospital. Their rage increased when they found numerous bodies in various states of mutilation. Mayor James Duane ordered the doctors and the students into a jailhouse for protection. The mob grew, forcing the remaining physicians into hiding. An estimated 20 people died in the resulting confrontation. A year following the incident, a law was enacted to codify the proper treatment of corpses. Condemned criminals were offered as replacements, but couldn't satisfy the need for bodies. Physicians continued hiring resurrection men to obtain them illegally. The progression of medical and surgical sciences waited a long time to finally open up and poke around inside a human. While Greek physicians in the early part of the 3rd century did perform dissections, surgical exploration was largely limited to animals. Roman law forbade human autopsy, leaving a short list of things to cut apart. It wasn't until a series of royal edicts in 16th century England allowed specific groups of physicians and surgeons limited right to dissect cadavers. The Royal College of Physicians and the Company of Barber Surgeons were the only groups allowed to carry out the task, and only had 10 cadavers annually between them. The Murder Act of 1752 allowed the bodies of executed murderers to be dissected for research and education in the hope to satisfy the need for bodies in the rapidly growing medical schools. The act included provisions for better preventing the horrid crime of murder, that some further terror and peculiar mark of infamy be added to the punishment, and that in no case whatsoever shall the body of any murderer be suffered to be buried, by mandating either public dissection or hanging in chains of the cadaver. Being dissected was, in effect, a fate worse than death. Think about it. You're not only executed for your crimes, now you have fumbling students who know basically nothing handling your corpse and picking it apart. Insult to injury is a bit of an understatement at that point. Of course, dissections, once allowed, became a popular form of entertainment. When there was nothing else to do, people could pay to watch the local surgeons open a body. Surgeons wore street clothes with aprons over them, and in a world where sterilization wasn't popular, or believed in, conducted the procedures without gloves. After all, blood was just blood. There's nothing dangerous about that. Body snatching, however, was no easy task, though with the punishment being no more than a fine or imprisonment, it was a sufficiently lucrative trade. Friends and relatives of the recently deceased would watch over the body until, and after, burial. Iron coffins became popular, as well as mort safes, or an iron framework placed over the graves. Bodies were often stored in mort houses until decomposition rendered them valueless. If you wanted to exhume your nightly paycheck, you'd start at the head of the grave, preferably digging with a wooden spade. Once the coffin was opened, you'd place a rope around the body and drag it out. Remember, taking the body is fine, but if you steal jewelry or clothing, you're looking at a felony charge. Whether or not the Resurrection Men were superstitious regarding their night work isn't well known. I'd imagine some were, but not enough to deter them from the task. It's easier to ask forgiveness than permission, right? In America, resurrectionists were known to hire women to act as grieving relations in order to claim the dead from poorhouses. The lady resurrectionists also attended funerals to scope out any potential hardships the body snatchers may encounter during their disinterment. The most famous grave robbers, the ones you likely think about when you think of grave robbing in general, made a name for themselves in 1828. William Burke and William Hare curated a total of 16 victims for Dr. Robert Knox, a well-known surgeon in Edinburgh, Scotland. The first body they sold allegedly belonged to a man who died of natural causes in Margaret and William Hare's lodging house. Having died owing Hare rent, Hare took his payment by selling the corpse for £7. In today's currency, that's £71, or 1,130 American dollars. Not bad for found wages. Having made a nice profit, Burke and Hare set their sights on furthering their business. Their first official victim was an ill tenant named Joseph Crosswaith. The two men plied him with whiskey and smothered him. With too many tenants in good health, Burke and Hare decided to harvest people from the streets. Abigail Simpson was their next victim, also intoxicated and smothered. Two undated murders came before that of Mary Patterson and the intended murder of Janet Brown. Brown, however, walked away with her life. The bodies were smuggled to Knox in a tea chest. Some claim that Patterson and Brown had been prostitutes, but there's no evidence of that truth. A scavenger woman named Effie fetched them £10. From there, Burke's M.O. took a darker turn. He saved a drunk woman from arrest, assuring the police he knew her and would bring her home. He delivered her body to Knox hours later. He drugged an elderly woman with painkillers and broke her 12-year-old grandson's back. That one, according to Burke's later testimony, appeared to haunt him. Tea chest being too small, he stuffed the two into a herring barrel. One of Burke's own relatives made the victim's list, a cousin of his wife. Hare's wife suggested Burke do away with his own, which he refused. Mary Haldane and her daughter, Peggy, met their deaths in Hare's stable. Taking people who wouldn't be missed saved the murderers a lot of questioning, but it wasn't until they took a young man named Daft Jamie that their luck went south. Jamie's mother began searching for him, and when the body was delivered to Knox, many of his students recognized him. Knox allegedly dissected the body ahead of schedule to render the remains unrecognizable. Burke then made the grave error of giving Jamie's clothing to his nephews, creating a trail of evidence. He left the body of his last victim, Mary Dougherty, under a bed in the lodging house. Her body was identified in Knox's dissection room. Lord Advocate Sir William Ray offered Hare the chance to be granted immunity if he confessed and agreed to turn on Burke. Journalist Christopher North later described the men in his Blackwood magazine article. Although there was nothing repulsive about Burke, who was certainly not deficient in intellect, he was steeped in hypocrisy and deceit, his collected and guarded demeanor full of danger and guile, a cool, calculating, callous, and unrelenting villain. Hare, on the other hand, was the most brutal man ever subjected to my sight, and at first look seemingly an idiot. He also compared the two men's wives, saying that Mrs. Hare had more of the she-devil in her. Burke was hanged on January 28, 1829. On the 29th, he was publicly dissected. A limited number of tickets were issued for the event. The event was so popular, they brought tours of 50 people in groups at a time to walk through the dissection chamber. My personal favorite part of the Burke and Hare story is its ending. Burke's skeleton is on display in the Anatomy Museum of Edinburgh Medical School. If that doesn't sate you, you can find his death mask and a book supposedly bound in his tan skin at the Surgeons' Hall Museum. If that's still not enough, rumor has it that wallets were crafted from Burke's skin as well. One said to be taken from the back of his left hand sold at auction for £1,050 in 1988. Knox was never tried for providing incentive to murder. Hare left Edinburgh, and no one's really sure what happened to him. The Burke and Hare murders incited the Anatomy Act of 1832, which authorized people in legal custody of a body to send it to a medical school before burial, likely the only way I'd be able to attend medical school these days, for the study of anatomy and surgical practice. They also ended anatomizing as part of the death sentence for murder. Sadly, grave robbing isn't exactly a thing of the past. While corpses generally don't need to worry about being stolen for needy surgeons or medical schools, people do vandalize cemeteries and graveyards, causing massive amount of damage to headstones, relics, and other properties. Portraits go missing. Statues are stolen. If you've taken anything from the obscene number of horror films, books, television shows, and, you know, living in general, you should know that removing anything from a cemetery is a bad, bad idea. Don't do it. Don't steal from the dead. Carl Tanzer was a radiologic technologist in Key West, Florida, who developed a morbid obsession with Elena Milagro de Hoyos. While it starts out like a tale of clandestine love, it's anything but. Elena died of tuberculosis. Carl kept her corpse for 7 years, having stolen it 2 years after she died. During his childhood, Tanzler claimed to have had a vision of the face of his true love. When he saw Elena in the hospital, he knew it was her. Throughout her treatment, Tanzler showered her with gifts, professing his love to her, but she never reciprocated his feelings. Despite his best efforts, she died, and after her death, Tanzler paid for her funeral and constructed an above-ground mausoleum for her body. 2 years later, he stole it, later claiming that her spirit begged him to do so. He articulated her corpse using wire and coat hangers, replaced her skin with silk soaked in wax and plaster as it fell off. He made a wig of her own hair and stuffed her abdominal and chest cavities with rags to keep her form. The body he kept in his bed. Elena was eventually discovered after rumors surfaced about Tanzler sleeping with her corpse. He was found mentally competent and stood trial for wantonly and maliciously destroying a grave and removing a body without authorization. Despite all of the creepy and overwhelming evidence, the case was dropped due to the statute of limitations. Elena's body was buried in secret in an unmarked grave to prevent further tampering. If you are not easily spooked, you can find photographs of her plaster and wax second skin online. In the 1950s, a strange, shy boy named Edward Gain would soon become a notorious killer and body snatcher. Gain exhumed corpses from local graveyards and fashioned their bones and skin into trophies and keepsakes. He murdered two women, Mary Hogan and Bernice Warden, and it's questionable whether or not he murdered his own brother. Warden's body was found in a shed, decapitated and hung upside down. Upon investigation, police found whole and fragmented bones, four noses, a pair of lips on a window shade drawing, human skin covering chair seats, bowls made from skulls, Warden's heart in a plastic bag, and Mary Hogan's face in a paper bag. Gain claimed he made as many as 40 visits to three local graveyards, but occasionally came out of his daze and left empty-handed. Shortly after his mother's death, Gain began creating a woman suit, wanting to literally become his mother. If you think that sounds familiar, it's because Robert Bloch fictionalized it in his 1959 suspense novel, Psycho, which director Alfred Hitchcock later brought to the screen. Gain also inspired Leatherface, Buffalo Bill, and Bloody Face from the television anthology American Horror Story. He was found guilty of the murders, but pronounced legally insane. Though not grave robbing, per se, in 2002, Tri-State Crematory here in Georgia was investigated for failure to cremate hundreds of bodies. Ray Brent Marsh claimed to be having issues with the cremation machines. So instead, he dumped the corpses, giving the families urns of cement dust instead of remains. When tested, the oven was found to be in working order. Marsh was charged with theft by deception, abusing a corpse, burial service fraud, and giving false statements. The case was settled after the defense questioned the pecuniary value of the over 200 corpses. The short answer? They were worth nothing. In 2006, an oral surgeon named Michael Mastromariano was convicted of illegally harvesting human bones, organs, tissue, and other parts from individuals awaiting cremation. He forged consent forms and sold the parts to medical companies. Then there's the embalmer from Colorado who stole gold teeth from his victims. Pawnbrokers noticed Adrian Klein frequently bringing in dental gold, which they felt was creepy and weird. Another mortuary worker in England stole 125 gold crowns from the dead over the course of a year. A few months ago, a Tumblr post created a lot of noise in the death community. Yes, there's a death community, comprised of those of us who study forensics, archaeology, have a death-positive attitude, or just like what's commonly considered morbid. A user posted regarding the potential sale of bones collected from a poor man's graveyard, bones they didn't dig up but were found on the soil. For the price of shipping, this person would give them to you to be used in rituals or for whatever you'd like. State laws regulate the procurement and sale of human remains. In the state of this Tumblr user, selling bones is a crime. Popular websites like Etsy have modified their terms of service to exclude the sale of bones and organs, while still allowing items like mourning jewelry, necklaces, earrings, or rings traditionally made from the hair of the deceased, to be sold. Auction sites such as eBay, however, have other restrictions in place, claiming that human remains may be sold for educational purposes only. Sure, bones are, technically speaking, inorganic material. Seeing a skeleton on display in a classroom is hardly the same as seeing a flesh-covered cadaver, but nonetheless, those remains belong to somebody who was, and possibly someone who still is. While our relationship with death is pretty closed off and shrouded in denial, the idea of remains a comfort. Graves aren't for the dead so much as the living. If you are looking to fill your cabinet of curiosities, you need not resort to grave robbing. In fact, please don't. It's still illegal, so stop. There are ethical methods of procuring skulls and bones. Record keeping is important. Do your research before you buy anything, and make sure you know your state laws regarding selling, purchasing, or transporting. Private collectors, deacquisitioned museum collections, and medical schools may be your best sources. Talk to people in the industry. Learn everything you can. Antique and oddity shops are also surprisingly great resources. And once I did hear a rumor about somebody purchasing a human skull at a Goodwill. I wouldn't start there, though. Seriously, don't go around digging up graves. You'll face more than a fine and some jail time if caught. Especially if you, like me, believe in ghosts. Courting Casualties is the monthly podcast produced by me, Megan Harker. Since I was little, I've been obsessed with monsters, and that remains true today. I specialize in Victoriana, and I'm currently working on my own gothic horror novel. In the modern world, I am the horror writer for girlsandcapes.com, where I talk about horror in books, television, and film. I also write for criminalelement.com, where I talk about American Horror Story and Hemlock Grove. You can find me on Twitter at exquisitelyodd, or on my website, exquisitelyodd.com. I'm also on Instagram at Megan_Harker, where I post in-progress and completed artwork, and occasionally photos of my cat. If you think that artwork is cool, you can buy prints and other things in my Society6 shop at society6.com/Megan Harker. Don't forget, I will be at AnacroCon here in Atlanta, February 26th through 28th. My track schedule is posted on my website, and I am so excited to be able to share ghost stories and talk about my favorite Victorian and horror topics. The music in this episode is Veins, composed by Kevin MacLeod and used under the Creative Commons license. If you enjoyed this show, please consider subscribing. Reviews are also appreciated. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, stay strange.